I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Centers for Disease Control announced last week that we are at the very peak of an active flu season. Young children are among the most susceptible to these outbreaks. So today, our Children's Health series resumes with how to tell the sniffles of a common cold from the vicious virus influenza, and they'll have advice for getting your child on the road to recovery. Then we'll ask how much screen time is too much for your tots and teens and all your kiddos in between. We'll turn to the doctors again for healthy tech guidelines for children. We'll close the hour with this month's edition of A Fan's Notes. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's flu season out there, as if you haven't noticed, right? Turns out that many of our kids, not to mention us adults out there, are suffering and suffering a lot. This morning, as part of our ongoing Children's Health series, we're going to look at some ways to handle this treacherous flu season with your kids, as many are finding out getting a flu shot hasn't helped a whole lot. Then later on this hour, a conversation about how much screen time your kids should be getting these days will offer some healthy tech tips for kids with the help of a Children's Mercy Hospital clinical psychologist. First, though, dealing with the flu, and with us, Dr. Mary Ann Jackson is director of the Division of Infectious Diseases over at Children's Mercy. Dr. Jackson, so nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Natasha Burgert is with Pediatric Associates just north of the plaza. She's our regular guide on our monthly children's health shows, and Natasha, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Well, Dr. Jackson, how bad is this flu season out there?
Well, in the last week, we have seen a 50% increase in the number of flu detections at Children's Mercy.
Wow.
And we think we're just now at the peak of disease. But if you think your children have been sick since September, there's a reason for that. There have been approximately a dozen viruses circulating, but flu has taken center stage in the last couple of weeks.
Does that suggest that these viruses that are out there are becoming more dangerous, more prevalent, and do we have a problem with that?
This is a pretty typical season, I'd have to say. I think there's some misconceptions that are out there regarding the type of flu specifically that we're seeing and the role for vaccine, which I think is more protective than what most of the public media messages suggest.
The vaccine has been better than it's been given credit for.
Well, keep in mind that influenza vaccine covers a number of different viruses. And in terms of influenza right now in Kansas City, based on detections at Children's Mercy, there are at least four circulating strains. And the flu vaccine protects against four. H3N2 has gotten all the media publicity because it has been the most prevalent strain. It always causes bad disease. It's always spread by school-aged children and gets to all aspects of the population. But a third of the strains we've seen of the flu A strains at Children's Mercy in the last month are H1N1 strains. And the vaccine should be better against those strains than it is against H3N2. And on top of that, we have a significant number of flu B strains. And if you look at national data, among 20 children who've died, a third of them have died with flu B. So vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. And it is still the season to get your children protected.
So, Dr. Natasha Burgert, why is it then that my wife, who got a flu shot, last fall, was just sicker than all get out a couple weeks ago, and it lasted a whole week?
Yeah, I know, and that's the challenge that a lot of parents are asking us. You know, my perspective is we're busy. We're seeing a lot of kids with flu. Many of them who have contracted influenza, either A or B, have been vaccinated, like your wife's experience. But I can tell you, for the kids that we've seen, my opinion is that the kids who have been vaccinated are getting some protection from how severe the disease is to them. So the sickest kids that I've seen have not been vaccinated.
Okay, so even getting the vaccination helps with the severity then if you come down with the flu.
That is what I'm experiencing for the kids that I'm seeing.
How much traffic have you had at Pediatric Associates because of the flu outbreak here?
It is, we're having some record level days. And it's kind of all hands on deck. We're trying the best, as all primary care clinics are, to accommodate our families as best we can, because we really want to keep these kids out of the ERs.
You know, Dr. Jackson, I'm still a little confused here. So if you got the vaccination, the vaccine, a lot of people think that, hey, if I have it, I will never get sick the whole year. But then they do get sick, and that happens why?
Well, the vaccine is partially protective against certain strains.
Okay.
But what
partially
we know,
protective.
Partially
okay.
protective. And so what you can say, and this is consistent with Dr. Burkert has suggested, is that you are less likely to be hospitalized and you will be less likely to die. And so I put it to parents this way. If somebody told you you had a 2 in 10 chance of winning the lottery, would you buy a ticket? Yes. Buy a ticket and get vaccinated. You'll protect yourself. You'll protect those around you who are high risk for complications of influenza. And you will be less likely to be hospitalized and less likely to die. And so in the cases around the country, in the deaths that have occurred, the vast majority of those individuals are unvaccinated.
Natasha, Dr. Burkert, remind us here, even kids can get vaccinated for the flu?
Yes, all children above the age of 6 months. It is,
oh, really?
It is recommended that they get the flu. So 6 months and above, we still, in our office, and I've heard around the city, still have adequate flu vaccine available to give. So
is it too late then?
No, it is not. It is not too late. And we have to keep in mind that even kids that I'm seeing that come in that are positive for influenza, we are still vaccinating them because they can get protection from the other strains that are still circulating. So they don't have to go through this twice.
So as young as 6 months, you can get vaccinated then.
Absolutely.
Well, do we have any idea what percentage of kids in Kansas City get the flu vaccine?
In our practice, it's fairly high. Marianne, you might have some better
numbers. National data suggests that children are the best covered of all populations in terms of flu vaccine. Having said that, it's just 60% of children across the country who will have had flu vaccine. In practices like Dr. Burkert's, where they're very proactive with vaccines, the numbers are going to be somewhat higher. The population that is least likely to be vaccinated, and this may not be a surprise, are those 19 to 49, especially those without children, perhaps especially men, who perceive that I've never had the flu, I don't need to worry about it. And yet, as you hear media across the country, this is where some of the deaths are occurring.
But you hear a lot of people say, I've never had the flu before, so I don't bother with the shot. What do you say to them?
I say the attack rate is not 100%, but if you do contract the flu, it is a miserable disease. And if you're lucky enough to only have a week at home in bed, that's baseline. If you are high risk, and so in looking at populations, I say, as you're considering a flu vaccine, do you love someone who's under 6 months? Do you love someone with cancer, with heart disease, with diabetes, who has some other type of immune compromising condition, is under the age of 2 or over the age of 65? You are protecting this population that may actually not respond as well to vaccine as, for instance, otherwise healthy individuals are.
So when someone, either a kid or an adult, Dr. Jackson, contracts the flu virus, what happens to the body? What happens when you get the flu?
So the flu is associated with acute onset, and not like colds with a little bit of fever where you have vague symptoms for a couple of days. But people can look at the clock and say, at 11:18 on this day, all of a sudden I feel like I was hit by a truck with horrible myalgia, with headache, and high fever.
What's happening inside your body when this thing hits?
Well, this is an respiratory invasive virus, and so it attaches to respiratory mucosa. It produces high levels of inflammation with cytokine formation, and so fever-producing agents, and lots of mucus, lots of secretions, and in some cases, plugging of airways, so that 40% of individuals with the flu who've had true influenza will develop a bacterial infection on top of that. And those bacterial infections can be sinus infections, which can be complicated, pneumonia, which can be complicated, bloodstream infections, which can be life-threatening.
So this is just a mess. This is just a hurricane hitting your body here.
It is indeed.
Yeah. Natasha, how do you avoid it? I mean, what do people need to know and be reminded of here?
Well, one thing we've already alluded to is certainly that it's not too late to get vaccinated. So That's number one. I agree with that. I'm sure Dr. Jackson does as well. The next thing that we have to that I always tell my patients is we have to remember just general things that keep our body well. We have to keep washing our hands. We have to get good rest, prioritize our nutrition, and we need to stay home when we're sick. And so I think that when families kind of come together as a unit, especially like you may have experienced when someone in your house is ill, it's kind of an all, you know, everyone has to band together. And that transmission can happen within home fairly easily, but with reasonable precautions. I have had numerous families where there has been only one person in the family who has gotten flu. So one kid getting flu in your house does not necessarily mean that everyone's going to get it if you follow routine stuff.
But I didn't. Yeah. And I washed my hands so they were almost, the skin was peeling off and did lice all over the place and really put on a show inside my house. You know?
No, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I know we're getting kids coming in to the office with just these crazy chapped hands but they're coming in for well visits, so that's good.
Yeah, okay. If our listeners have questions about the flu and maybe someone in their house has it right now and you're looking for some good advice, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. How do I know, Dr. Jackson, if my kid has the flu or a cold?
So I alluded to the fact that colds are less fever, less systemic symptoms. So in the individual with high fever, respiratory symptoms, those are the children that are more likely to have influenza. There is testing. The rapid testing that is in physicians' offices, for the most part, detects the germ itself, the antigen. It is not a perfect test. There are molecular tests that look for genetic material that are better, but they're more expensive. And so physicians really have to make a decision. Does this look like influenza? The higher the fever, the sicker the child, the more likely this is flu.
So the flu is just worse.
The flu is worse in every way. And then there's another important point. You probably heard, Steve, that the CDC got together and decided we have to have an emergency meeting about influenza. They scrapped another meeting that was supposed to happen and they targeted influenza. And I think their messages, including vaccinate and prevent spreading, include one more major message. And that is there is an antiviral called oseltamivir, known by the name Tamiflu that's
right
out there. It is clearly underutilized. In one study of children, they found only 5% were offered this medication. And so on January 10th, a message was sent out to providers in our region from Children's Mercy saying, you need to remember that this drug is out there. You need to use it in appropriate cases. So under 2, over 65, high-risk patients, anyone who is hospitalized with influenza, we need to utilize this drug better. So the importance of antivirals.
Is it a remedy for the flu or what is Tamiflu?
So just like penicillin is an antibiotic for strep, oseltamivir is an antiviral that is for flu. And it is specifically for influenza. It does not treat any other viruses, but it will shorten the course, shorten the duration of viral shedding, because you can shed this virus for 5 to 7 days, and that's how.
What does that mean, shed it?
That means it's in your secretion. So flu is spread by small droplet. Mm-hmm. And so if you sit next to somebody who's coughing all over you, are more likely to have exposure to it. Children shed virus in their secretions longer than adults do. Adults may only have this contagion period for 2 to 5 days. Children, it may be 5 to 10 days. Mm. For high-risk hosts, it can be even longer. So it's all about the spread, and it's all about decreasing virus in secretions. It's all about ameliorating the signs and symptoms. And we know that treatment can indeed prevent deaths if it's optimally given within the first 48 hours of symptoms.
Dr. Burgert, I was just going to say what Mary Ann just said there. You got to take Tamiflu quickly once the symptoms show up, right? You can't wait a week.
No, that's right. You do. And but to Dr. Jackson's point, this is for most of our families that are coming in, it is very clear that this is different. This is not just a cold. My kid is sick. My two-year-old is saying everything hurts. They have headaches. They are ill appearing, not like a typical runny nose. And so it is. It's clear what for most families, it is very clear that yes, I need to come in and get tested.
We're talking about how to deal with the flu when your kids contract it here this morning on Up to Date. 816-235-2888 is our number. Frank from Lawrence. Frank, good morning.
Good morning. First of all, you might explain what myalgia means. And next, on a previous event like this, they mentioned some particular flu shot was good for next year. I don't know if that's true. And then regarding the payment of this, I'm actually with Medicare, and I can get it free, although the hospital charged me $85 a while back. For children, I guess if they have insurance, what's the cost? And if they have Medicaid, is it free? And you might discuss the cost of these flu shots.
Okay, thanks. Frank, thank you. How about the cost of the flu shot? Marianne, I'm guessing it varies dramatically based on what kind of insurance you have and who you work for and everything else.
Absolutely correct. For children who are covered by Medicaid, there are many of these, for the vast majority that are covered by the Vaccine for Children program from the CDC, vaccine is free. Many insurance policies cover vaccines, including influenza vaccine. For the child who does not have insurance, there are some opportunities to access free vaccine that can be found in the communities. Almost every hospital is offering a family and friends vaccine.
Drugstores offer them pretty cheaply too sometimes.
So
right?
The drugstore rates are actually pretty reasonable. They do a good job with vaccination, particularly for the young adult and adult population.
Our caller also wanted to know about what is myalgia?
Myalgia is muscle aches. And these are not just little muscle aches like you might get after you lifted weights. These are profound muscle aches. They're usually the back and neck area where they are so severe, these muscle aches prevent you from lifting your arms, from getting comfortable in bed. And most children do not say, my muscles hurt. So when Natasha says, we have children coming into our practice with high fever complaining their muscles hurt, that is a very distinctive finding for flu.
Okay. He had a final question about some kind of shot, a flu shot for next year already, or is that's not out yet, is it?
No. So part of our problem with flu and protection with flu vaccine is that every year we need to develop a new flu vaccine.
Because things change out there.
Because the viruses that circulate have a change in their antigen content, meaning their molecular makeup. Each year changes slightly. So the vaccine from last year, the duration of immunity is about 6 to 7 months, and the virus itself changes slightly. We clearly need a better vaccine for flu, and a universal vaccine, I think, is within 5 to 7 years down the line.
You know, Natasha, a lot of times, you know, parents wonder, their kid begins to come down with a cold, what appears to be a cold, and they wonder about sending their kid to school that day, or should they keep him home, and do they gut it out at school, or do they stay home and be a little safer? What do you advise?
I think that's up to every family. It's obviously a terrible choice in the morning, right? Do we go to work? Do we not go to work? Do we go to daycare? I mean, and that's
I've been there.
Yeah, and it's a struggle. And I think we have to look at a child globally, and I think you have to trust your gut. So clearly, if your child wakes up with a fever or if they're vomiting, they should not be going to school. If they're complaining of just some more mild symptoms and you get them out of bed and get them kind of going and they have some breakfast and they really perk up and they generally look like themselves, then although they may not be 100%, they're probably okay to go to school. And I would say that if your child, if it's on the borderline with that too and your body's fighting infections, sending them back to school, a petri dish of other viruses that is going on, it might make them a little bit more susceptible to catching something else. So I have a healthy level of caution for my kids when they're saying they're not well. I think we have to make reasonable common sense choices, but certainly fever, vomiting, they got to stay home.
Are there other things that kids can pick up this time of year outside of the flu, outside of the cold? What else is out there?
Oh, we've got a whole bunch of stuff out there, Steve.
A whole smorgasbord
here
for me.
Flu does not like to play by itself. There's a whole bunch of people in the sandbox. Yeah, so we're already seeing RSV, which is a respiratory illness that's specifically affecting our younger kids. A wheezy cold, we like to call it. We've got a lot of different flu-like illnesses that are going around, very flu-like mimickers going around. We've seen a lot of strep in our office. So if your child is ill, it's worth a visit. I don't want to, beat a dead horse here, but that's what our primary care office is for. I want families to call us. I know we're busy and we appreciate their patience, but we're really trying to accommodate everyone. And I know practices around our city are so that we can keep kids out of the ER unless they are really, really, really ill.
And I'd bring up just a very important point. Natasha's right. Strep is in season. We always see the peak of strep in the winter at the same time we see viruses. However, children with sore throat and viral symptoms, meaning runny nose, croupy cough, they should not be tested for strep. Otherwise, you're going to pick up the third of kids, 25% or so of kids who are carriers. And so kids with runny nose and creepy cough have virus. Kids who are school age and have sore throat in and of itself, sometimes with headache, but sore throat is predominant with some other findings in the throat. Those are the kids to test for strep throat. So okay. I want parents to know and be smart about as they ask for testing.
And Dr. Jackson, what age would you recommend a child be tested? For example, would you recommend a two-year-old be tested?
Such a great question. We do not recommend testing for children under the age of three for strep. And the reason for that is twofold. One, they don't get traditional strep throat. And the reason we treat strep throat is to prevent rheumatic fever. And that is at least one of the couple reasons. And so rheumatic fever doesn't occur in children under the age of three. So under three, they are more likely to have a virus. Strep throat is not classic in that age group. In the children between the ages of, say, 18 months and 3 years who have a household contact with strep, those might be reasonable. Otherwise, under three, no. Look for school-age children with strep, and then look for all the viruses.
You know, we're talking about all this awful stuff that's out there. How do you guys avoid getting sick yourselves? I mean, what do you do inside a medical office this time of year?
Have you seen my hands? They're chapped, just
they're
like
chapped.
Everybody's else. We take the precautions as we can, and I think, my job affords me a little bit of exposure to everything all the time. So we've developed a very robust immune system ourselves. Of course, I get the flu shot and all other recommended vaccines to keep me healthy. But a general pediatrician like me who's seeing, 30, 40 kids a day means I'm washing my hands 60 to 80 times a day. So,
wow.
so that keeps us well.
You too?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I have Purell on my desk in my home, in our office space. I've
and
just
you
asked
use it a lot.
For a new hand hygiene to be placed outside in the stairwell because I am worried of people going down the stairwell holding on with their virusy hands.
Yep, absolutely. Well, Dr. Marianne Jackson, again, Director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Children's Mercy, thanks for coming in today and sharing your expertise with us about the flu. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break. Dr. Natasha Berger is going to stay with us. We're going to switch and talk about screen time and some tech tips involving your kids in our second half here. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. And just for the record, I tell Alexa at my house to play KCUR all the time. That's just what I do. And my wife does it, too. That's a common phrase around our house these days. Yesterday, we were joined by one of the greats in today's jazz scene. That's Marcus Roberts, who taught himself to play piano after losing his sight at the age of five. He'll be performing this weekend at the Folly Theater Friday night, 8 o'clock. You can find my conversation with him at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we'll talk with a woman who woke up to her white privilege and began to question her assumptions about race relations in the U.S. And we'll examine the health implications of loneliness. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, now the second part of our Children's Health Show today, and that's examining how much tech time your kids should be getting each day and how to manage this evolving frontier in the lives of our kids. This issue was in the news this month when a pair of investors who say they hold about $2 billion in Apple stock started pushing the company to do more to protect its youngest users from the effects of digital technology. Believe me, I've had some second thoughts about this very subject when it comes to the way we raised our own kids. With us now, Dr. Carla Allen is a clinical psychologist and director of the ADHD Specialty Clinic over at Children's Mercy. And Dr. Allen, welcome to you. Nice to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And still with us again, Dr. Burgert from Pediatric Associates. Dr. Allen, do we really know what kind of impact cell phones and computers are having on us and our kids, and maybe more specifically on our brains, or are we still wallowing in some level of ignorance when it comes to that frontier?
We're still learning more and more every day, but there are definitely some really big impacts of being plugged into the screen, so to speak. So some of the things that we know is that when you're plugged into the screen, you're missing out on real-world opportunities to interact and engage with socially with people and to engage in exercise. And so we know that there is an increased risk for obesity, attentional problems, and depression is, I think, the really big thing to be concerned about, particularly with teens as it relates to smartphone use.
Oh, why depression? Why does that enter into this?
So what we know is that, again, our brains do best when we're interacting with people in the real world. And social media time is really associated with less of that, less of that real world kind of conversational experience. But also, it's you are constantly being shown people who are doing and showing their very best sorts of things about them, putting their best feet forward. And you're missing out on opportunities to see people as real people with real mistakes. And so increases in smartphone usage 2 hours a day or more really seem to be putting people at risk for depression and suicidal ideation. Too.
Over 2 hours a day, you're saying there. Dr. Burgert, just guessing here that you are asked this question about how much time my kids should be spending in front of the one screen or another. I bet you get asked that a lot.
This is one of parents' greatest concerns today.
I can imagine. And the struggle is we have some answers, as Dr. Allen is saying, but we don't have lots of answers here.
Just like Dr. Allen said, I mean, this is such a dynamic and interesting field because there's so many different parts and there's so many different places to do this type of research. But I think what also is maybe stressful to me as a pediatrician is, especially kids, you know, I have a fifth grader and I've got a second grader. My kids are part of this digital experiment, and we don't know the long-term consequences of the choices that we're making today, unlike other health and wellness issues that parents need to make. So
that's a pretty scary thing you just said.
Yeah,
we don't really know the consequences of what our kids are being exposed to every day.
Right. And I think that where we have to put our parenting hats on to kind of look at things more globally and look at how these tech devices are affecting our children, we have to keep a pulse on the research. And, you know, quite honestly, that's overwhelming.
If we don't know and we're still in the dark here, Dr. Allen, are we asking for trouble?
You know, I feel like we really need to resort back to trust your gut instincts about this. And, you know, from a very basic common sense level, when we're watching our children every day, we know they give us signs whether or not their use of media is problematic. So if your child comes home from a stressful day and the very first thing they run to is, you know, their screen time as a way of coping, that's a red flag that that's a problem. When kids can't, you know, step away from the screen time when it's over, that's a red flag that that's a problem too. And so, you know, using our guts as parents, when something feels wrong, trying to replace that time with some more, you know, real world social interaction, that's really what we need to get back to, is back to basics.
You know, that sounds good in theory, but as a parent myself, I know implementing those kinds of changes inside a household can be pretty difficult.
Right. Absolutely. They can be. And so I think, you know, starting young is really important.
Yeah.
Once you've gotten to the level where it's become a habit for kids, it's that much harder. But, you know, with real good sort of social contracting with our kids, when we set limits about it, but we show them what here's what you get out of not doing that. Here are the opportunities that are available to you that I'm happy to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's, you know, real world time going out to a movie theater with a friend. You know, those kinds of social interactions that really oftentimes gets replaced by smartphone usage, that can make it more likely that a teenager might tolerate those changes.
So how much time are we talking about then that you recommend for kids? Let's just talk about kids who are at least 2 or 3 years old and they begin to enter this world. What do you advise?
Yeah, so the American Academy of Pediatrics is really, I think, at the forefront of the movement in integrating this research and giving real-world recommendations. So they recommend for children aged 2 to 3 no more than 1 hour a day of screen time altogether. Mm-hmm. And that's because when you think about how much more time those kids spend sleeping, the amount of time during the day where they're awake, if it's all taken up with screen time, they don't get to do that real-world learning that improves social interaction and language functioning and all those kinds of things. So for 2 to 3-year-olds, no more than 1 hour a day is recommended.
How about older kids then?
So for those school-agers, that you're getting into the area of about 2 hours a day and no more than that. And the same really holds true for teenagers, especially, again, with social media use. That seems to be the thing that's really problematic in terms of increasing the risk for depression.
Okay. Let's get our listeners involved here. We're wondering how you're handling this issue of technology and kids at your house. And are you limiting screen time, signing contracts with your children about how much time they can spend on smartphones and the like? I'd like to know. Maybe you can share your own experiences with others who are listening here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, an article in HuffPost suggested that there are 4 critical factors necessary to achieve healthy child development. Those 4 are movement, touch, human connection, and exposure to nature. I don't see the word technology in any of those 4, Natasha.
No, and I think when we're thinking about that, I think that those 4 things are absolutely right. They're critical to a child's healthy development. And when it comes to the difficulties of that you alluded to, of trying to manage this in everyone's home, when we're thinking about our goal as a parent to raise a happy and healthy person, maybe we need to look to those 4 a little bit more.
How are you handling it in your house, can I ask?
Sure. So we we're like every other parent. We're taking it kind of day by day with what we're seeing with our own kids and what they present. So we, in general, have chosen in a lot of ways to delay. So we don't own an iPad in our house. We have 1 TV. We have chosen to make choices to set our kids up so they can have access to those items, but they don't really have the opportunity to get access. That being said, my son, my 2nd grader, was really excited that Santa did bring an Xbox this Christmas. So we're not anti-technology family. We know that those are fun things to do. But as that new device has gotten into our home, now we have watched him a little bit with how he has responded to that. And now we've made some healthy boundaries that we feel are maintaining what we know about him as a happy and healthy 2nd grader. Mm-hmm. So we're using what the Academy, just like Dr. Allen said, we're using those guidelines in general of what the Academy suggests. But for some families that I deal with in the office, I would say that those are even probably too generous before they start to see behavior change. And so, again, it's day by day and a willingness to reevaluate and correct and redirect, as I think our job as a parent is to do.
You know, what strikes me as interesting about this, Carla, is, Dr. Berger might have 1 set of rules for her house, but the kids next door or the children that her children associate with might have a completely different set of standards and guidelines in their own home. And peer pressure plays such an enormous factor here.
Absolutely. It really does. And I think that's one of the things that we really have to know. The settings in which we send our kids out into the world. And so knowing the parents and trying to, as best as we can, make sure that we have similar rules and guidelines about how much tech time and what the content of that is so important. So, it's not just the amount. The content really matters, too. So, for example, you alluded to some children have temperaments that make it such that even the 2 hours a day for school-agers is too much. The content drives that even more. So for children with difficult temperaments, hyperactive sort of temperaments, games that have some sort of violent content or mature, it just escalates those problems. And so, it there is overall overall guidelines, but then everyone needs to know their own child too.
One of the things that's the reality of life is that, our, you know, we can only control what's in our own home. We can't control what the neighbor's doing, and we can't control what happens at grandma's house. Okay, we just can't. So, I think part of maybe stepping back and taking a bigger look at this is we need to be arming our kids so that they have a skill set available, so that when they do get into a friend's house that's playing Call of Duty, or they do go to a friend's house and an inappropriate picture comes on the screen, they have the internal ability to manage that on their own. And what that takes is time. It takes brain development, and it takes a great connection with a parent. And you can't do that if the parents are looking at their phones all the time either.
I think that's all right. But boy, this is a completely new world. And sure. Again, when your child enters somebody else's house, you just don't know what they're about to be exposed to there. And that's scary.
No, it's terrifying.
We just don't know anymore.
It's absolutely terrifying. And so that's where that's why I'm so excited that you brought Dr. Allen and myself onto the show to talk about it. This needs to be a conversation that we're having with our friends and our family and our peers of what our expectations are, because you're exactly right. Everybody does it different, but we also can't take responsibility for things we can't control. And so all we can do is kind of protect and defend what we can and prepare our kids to go out there, whether that's using technology or whether that's driving a car.
How are you handling technology in your home when it comes to your kids? 816-235-2888 is our number, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dr. Allen, is there a link between today's technology and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? You've alluded to that here, also known as ADHD. What do we know about that?
So I think we know a couple of things. One thing that we know is that, you know, children who have more difficult temperaments are at risk for having greater screen time. The kids who have greater emotional dysregulation, they're at risk for having greater screen time precisely because screen time is a nice way to get them to do something so that we can step away as parents and do the things we need to do. And so, you know, over time, those things can really become cumulative. There was this great study that was published in Pediatrics in 2010 that showed that video game time was associated with increased attention problems 13 months later, as rated by teachers. So people who aren't even aware of how much screen time really do see the impacts of that later on down the road. So again, really monitoring those things, setting good limits when you can, actively participating in your children's consumption of screen time, those things all seem to really make a difference in outcome.
You know, one of the other big issues that every parent faces these days, or at least most parents do, is this idea of when do you get your child a smartphone, which only ramps up the exposure to technology. Natasha, what are you advising your own parents as they come in to see you?
Well, just like for all of the issues that Dr. Allen's mentioned and that I've experienced in the office, I think that the smartphone does place it amplifies the risk. It's gas to the fire when we start to give these kids essentially computers in their pocket. And one of the challenges of smartphones is they're difficult to manage. It's difficult to track them. Mm-hmm. The things are changing all the time. And I completely understand and have witnessed in my own children the peer-driven desire to have these devices. But I think that the tide is turning. I really believe that it is. There are more and more families that are coming to me and saying, what else can I do? And I think one of the more popular initiatives, a new initiative, is called waituntil8th.org. It's a parent-driven grassroots organization that is promoting delaying that introduction of a smartphone specifically until at least eighth grade. It's still pretty young, with the average age of a kid getting a smartphone being 9.5 to 10 these days, it's a significant difference in their developmental progress.
And that's fourth or fifth grade.
Yes,
that is
increasing or delaying that for some kids by as much as 4 or 5 years. That's a significant neurodevelopmental time to allow more maturity. It's still not without risk, but they are able to. It gives us time to develop the ability for them to navigate that space. I want to be clear that Wait Until 8th is not an anti-technology situation. They're supportive of learning technologies, educational technologies. They're supportive of using GPS devices to track kids, even offering young kids flip phones, old-fashioned flip phones, if you really need to connect with them. But when it comes to the smartphone, when it comes to that $1,000 computer in your pocket, it's encouraging families to wait. And it's doing it in a really unique way in that exactly what you mentioned with that peer-driven desire to have the smartphones. What it's doing is asking families to sign a pledge to say at waituntil8th.org to say, this is my child, this is their school, this is their grade. And once those information is entered, a pledge goes active, if you will, once 10 families of that particular school, of that particular grade, also sign the pledge. So what that's affording us is the ability to say, yes, there's other people in my community like
yes.
me. There's other people in my school that are like me.
What a great idea that is. Yeah.
There's other people we can, so parents can connect in online places to get support and ideas of how they're navigating it. They know that other families are concerned. And the kids, you know, I signed the pledge for my fifth grader. She knows. I'm a wait until eighth kid. And so that's just kind of the firm line in the sand. And there's I don't have to deal so much with the begging and the persuading, because that's the line.
Again, Carla, just hearing this good advice from Dr. Berger, I'm sitting here thinking in some households, waiting till eighth grade, it is going to be a civil war every day until that kid reaches eighth grade.
It's worth fighting, though, because, you know, from the research perspective, there's some research saying that just waiting until 14, so kind of that early high school, which I know is a little bit later than the eighth, but just that alone really decreases the likelihood of depression that's associated with smartphone and social media use. There seems to be something about that critical period of peer integration and self-esteem and trying to figure out who you are, all of those things that we battle in middle school. If we can just do that outside of the limelight of social media, there seems to be something that's good about that.
To what extent are school administrators, at least that you're aware of, Natasha, are they supportive of this waiting till eighth grade initiative?
They're all over the board, and I think that most are very supportive of protecting. That they want to help families make good decisions, and they want to promote their tech-based technologies. I think tech-based education is awesome, and there's amazing schools that do this well. But having technology in the school should not be a personal device that a child is bringing into the school. That's kind of where the schools, I think, are trying to navigate what's okay because we've provided it versus is it okay that Johnny just brings this iPhone to school and he's playing with it during the day? I think those are two very different issues and ones that some schools are doing better than others. And just like we've seen in France and on the coasts and all of these places, I mean, I think the trend is they're just getting rid of the personal devices altogether out of that educational sphere to protect it. That's the conversation that many schools around Kansas City are having today.
Dr. Allen, how young are some of the kids that you see who have smartphones already?
Oh, my goodness. I can tell you I've seen kids as young as second and third grade that have them. And, you know, I think it's precisely because parents want to be able to contact their children in emergencies. And for whatever reason, maybe they're reluctant to go back a few years to the flip phone. But I'll tell you that if for my own child, that would be the approach that I plan to take. I also plan to take the wait till eighth at least.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a strong distinction there between safety in connections and convenience in connections. And that's what parents need to navigate.
Do the tech time guidelines include the time kids need to spend on computer for homework?
So, you know, I think that is an ongoing consideration that we're all really struggling with because we don't know the impact of screen time as it relates to education. This is meant to really, reform how we do recreational time primarily.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. That's Dr. Carla Allen. She's with Children's Mercy Hospital. Dr. Natasha Bergert with Pediatric Associates. Thank you both for some good advice. We sure appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, look around any stadium on game day and you're bound to see more than a few in the crowd. From George Brett to Tony Gonzalez, the old jerseys are favorite players left behind. But all stars fade and rising stars soar out of reach of the payroll, especially in Kansas City. Parting can be such sweet sorrow. Well, sometimes. Victor Wishna explains in this month's edition of A Fan's Notes.
We sports fans love our teams. And even when we hate them, we sort of love to hate them. Their ups, their downs, the relationship continues. But sometimes it's more personal. Because when it comes to individual players, the ones we've gotten to know, the ones we love, there isn't always next year. And when the end comes, it can get complicated. As the old song goes, breaking up is hard to do. Comma, comma, down, doobie doo, down, down. Take the odd, are we going to get back together again or not, courtship between the Royals, along with their fans, and Eric Hosmer. When he walked off the field with Mike Moustakas, Lorenzo Cain, and Alcides Escobar during last season's final game, we all assumed it was into the sunset. As the old cliche goes, if you love something, let it test free agency. But the market has proven a little lukewarm. and the Royals have opened up their love and arms to the tune of a reported $147 million. So there's a chance this fling with Haas, who debuted as a Royal in 2011, might just survive the 7-year itch. But should it? That's a lot of money, and Hosmer is just one player. Last year, with much of the championship core still around him, he had his best season ever. The Royals didn't. But then, he is a winner and a leader, and how can you put a price on intangibles? And how can we bear the thought of seeing him in some other team's jersey? It's a different story for quarterback Alex Smith, who has 1 year left on his Chiefs contract. If sports talk radio is any indication, legions of fans say either Smith goes or they do. At least one set fire to his number 11 jersey, which seems like a colossal waste of money and lighter fluid. And those of us who, for some reason, watched it on YouTube will never get those 90 seconds back. But then, heartbreak will make people do crazy things. Crazy, perhaps, because Smith just had, statistically speaking, the best season of any QB in team history. His first half in the wildcard game against Tennessee was one of the best by a quarterback in the NFL playoffs ever. But then came the second half. Of course, it's not all Smith's fault. He doesn't play defense. He doesn't coach. He doesn't officiate. It's not that he's lost big games for the Chiefs. It's that he hasn't gone out there and won them, at least not often enough. And since he plays for a coach with his own late-game limitations and a franchise that has made an art form of postseason futility, it's not a good match, especially not when fans' eyes have started to wander. For the first time in forever, the Chiefs have a plan and a new crush. You don't trade up 17 spots in the draft to grab a quarterback in the first round for the first time since 1983 if you don't think you're in love. And when Patrick Mahomes ended the season by driving his new team for the winning score in the most meaningful, meaningless game in memory, hearts across KC fluttered anew. The Chiefs will likely move on from Smith, perhaps in exchange for a few draft picks. And the money they'll save by jettisoning his contract will allow them to surround their new beau with some talented tokens of their affection. As for Hosmer, it probably makes sense to let him go, too. To use those resources to get started on a rebuild that shouldn't take 30 years. It ain't over till it's over. But sometimes, it's over. We'll always have our memories of the good times. If this is farewell to Smith and to Hosmer, I think we can agree. Indeed, 'tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. But it's much better to have loved and won.
Breaking up is hard to do. Don't take your love.
Victor Wishin is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. Tomorrow we talk with the author of Waking Up White about the epidemic of silence that perpetuates racism in this country. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. All that we've been through.